Tom Woods Show, episode 1828.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. As you know, Harry's is the official razor of the Tom Woods Show. And for a limited time, Harry's is offering their starter set plus a free body wash for just $3 at harrys.com/woods. That's over a $16 value for just $3 at harrys.com/woods. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Well, as you know, there have been quite a few executive orders coming out of the Biden White House. And joining me to discuss these and the general phenomenon is Sarah Anderson, Director of Policy for FreedomWorks. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be with you.
Can you start off, actually, before we get into Biden, just telling me a little bit about your background? I know a few folks at FreedomWorks, but you and I have never met before.
Absolutely. Well, FreedomWorks was my first job out of college. I started as an intern in the policy department under my wonderful boss, Jason Pye. I actually got into politics sort of in a very ground-up way, which complements, I think, the ideas I have for politics itself, which is that people are better off when they come to things of their own nature instead of something specifically the government forcing it on them. I was a student of U.S. history, learning about just history throughout our country's past, realizing that pretty much every time the government got involved in something, they tended to mess it up, even if they came in with the best of intentions. Of course, the involvement of the government hamstringing a lot of what the private sector was looking to do and what people really can do when they look out for each other resulted in a worse outcome than the problem itself. And so that's really what informs my political philosophy. I graduated from the College of William and Mary kind of on a whim a year early, and I didn't really have an idea of what I wanted to do necessarily. I knew I wanted to work in politics, and I knew I wanted to get the government out of people's lives. I ended up at FreedomWorks, got hired on, and I've been there for the past 3.5 years, really working to just shrink the size and scope of the federal government. I mean, in my ideal world, neither you nor I nor any advocates of smaller government would even have a job because the government would be so small that we wouldn't be needed. So that's what I've been working towards the past couple of years, and that's what I've dedicated, you know, my career and my passions to, and I couldn't be happier to be at FreedomWorks to do that.
Okay, well, I was curious about this because I think you're probably one of the youngest people I've ever had on the Tom Woods Show. So just wanted to know, you know, who is this precocious person who's coming on my program? Okay, so let's turn now to what's been going on with Joe Biden and executive orders. Now, strictly speaking, there's no per se problem with executive orders if they're used correctly. For example, a pardon is an executive order, and everybody admits the president has that power. Or George Washington, by executive order, asked that the outgoing Confederation government prepare a report on the state of the country. Well, nobody really complained about that.
But absolutely.
That's, I would say, qualitatively different from the kind of thing we've seen going on so far with Biden. And it's particularly rich coming from him because he just got done saying to us not all that long ago that dictators rule this way. And now, you know, here he is doing it.
Right. I think there's a couple of main points to make here. I mean, I don't think you'll find a bigger advocate of Article I congressional powers than myself and some of the folks at FreedomWorks who really believe that it is in Congress's wheelhouse and it's delegated powers to Congress and the Constitution to make policy. But unfortunately, over the past 3, 4, 5 plus even more decades, Congress has continually abdicated a lot of power to the executive branch. So in a lot of ways, they've set this type of situation up where the executive branch is needed to carry out laws as per the Constitution, but they've given them so much power and latitude to do that, to interpret the laws that Congress passes. Congress will pass a law that says, you know, the Department of Education shall implement a program that blank. It leaves it so open-ended that there's so much authority now given to the executive branch to take these laws out of context and twist congressional intent of legislation to really make it what they want it to be. So that's kind of what set the stage for these overarching powers that now the executive branch carries out. Of course, the Obama administration set a precedent of numbers and numbers of executive orders, taking a lot of congressional law out of context, thinking about, you know, the Clean Power Plan and the Waters of the United States rule, other rules that take law and stretch it to the maximum degree. Trump administration comes in, of course, and every president after that is going to take executive power as a floor instead of as a ceiling, and they'll create their own new ceiling. And that's now what we're seeing with the Biden administration, of course, is using executive action to undo a lot of things that the Trump administration did, similarly to how the Trump administration came in with the eye toward undoing a lot of things that the Obama administration did. The key difference, the second point that I'll make here, of course, is that a lot of the new actions we've seen from the Biden administration in the realm of executive orders, they are regulatory actions that increase the regulatory burden on Americans, on businesses, on society, instead of most of the actions taken by the Trump administration were deregulatory actions to get rid of that regulatory burden, to free up Americans from red tape, and to allow the economy to operate a little bit more freely from government intervention where possible. So that's really the sticking point that I'm seeing in the Biden administration is A, the sheer number of executive orders. Somebody told me the other day it was about 42 executive actions. Before that, I had heard it was 37. Anyway, dozens and dozens. A, there's a lot of them. And B, they are increasing the regulatory burden on Americans.
If you go through, I've written a little something in one of my books on executive orders, where if you go through and you look at 19th century presidents, and you just focus on peacetime presidents, mm-hmm. there's almost no executive orders issued by any of them. And then you get to Grover Cleveland, and some of them may have to do with labor unrest. And so I think the highest number might have been like 70. And that was, even that was absolutely unheard of for a presidential term to have 70 executive orders.
Right.
And then with Teddy Roosevelt, it went up to over 1,000. And that, mm-hmm. I think, reflects a different philosophy of the presidency, a different sense of what the role of the president is. And I think that's carried through the 20th century now into the 21st. And particularly, we have such a divided country. There's this visceral desire to see your guy just carry through the things you want to see implemented, regardless of the niceties of constitutional procedure. I think that's why nobody really has a principled objection to this. It's only when their guy is the one not being able to do it that they suddenly howl about it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the partisan nature of politics today, is that everybody's on this team or that team, and you oppose something just because it's something that the other team is doing. It's interesting that you bring up, you know, the idea of what the Constitution does or does not say about things. It seems very few people, really on either side of the aisle, seem to put much of an eye toward what the text of the Constitution says. And one thing that it brings up in my mind, of course, with this current COVID emergency that we're dealing with, is president's executive authority to declare emergencies and what emergency powers mean in an administration. Fortunately, you know, last year, I believe it was maybe last year or 2 years ago, Senator Mike Lee, who is one of our heroes in the Senate, introduced a bill called the Article I Act, which put an eye toward reining in some of the president's executive powers in a time of emergency. And that was pre-COVID, you know? So these powers, of course, that are taken further and further and further, especially in the context of an emergency, I think should be worrying to Americans, in that, you know, anything that a president might decide is an emergency, if they're able to suspend your constitutional rights during it, if they're able to just increase the heavy hand of the federal government because something is declared an emergency without any congressional input, oversight, authorization, approval, or anything like that. That's what Mike Lee was trying to get at with his Article I Act bill, which I think would go a long way in saying, hey, no, the Congress is actually going to be a check on the executive in this time, similar to the Reins Act for regulations as well. I think that would go a long way in sort of restoring the Constitution.
Let's talk now about specifics, about what has been in some of these executive orders. There are a handful of them that have gotten a lot of headlines. People are like the Keystone Pipeline, stuff like that.
Sure.
We should probably review. There might be other ones that haven't made the headlines, but that are nevertheless also significant that you might want to bring up. But walk us through some of these.
Yeah, of course, the one that you bring up has been a hot button issue in terms of especially jobs in our country. People are agitated at President Biden for canceling the Keystone XL pipeline, which did have a lot of jobs for Americans in them. Of course, they are government-created union jobs, so they're not my ideal job. But the point remains that sort of President Biden's response to people saying, hey, you got rid of my job, was, you know, find another job. Seems to me to be a kind of crass statement from President Biden, who, of course, Democrats always purport to be the party of the working man, of course, actually the party of these types of union labor jobs. He doesn't seem to care when it suits his progressive agenda or the agenda of, you know, the left that seems to be guiding him at this point in time. Of course, rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, part of that executive order as well, which is really problematic because it puts so much of the burden on the United States to basically single-handedly try to address climate change across the country while giving a free pass to countries like India and China, who have continued to increase their pollution over the past couple of years, whereas the United States, even being out of the Accords, has continued to demonstrate reductions in our pollution numbers. So that was, of course, one of the big ones on climate. You know, then I'm glad to turn to healthcare next, because I think that's where the American people are really going to see an impact on their quality of care, especially during a pandemic.
Yeah, definitely. Let's do that. Now, some people may say, and I would tend to think, even though I haven't looked, that the more radical environmentalists would think that rejoining the Paris Accord is purely symbolic because mm-hmm. there's no enforcement teeth or anything. It's more of a pledge or something. And this could be the kind of thing that you would say you might do to appease certain members of the party. But I'm not so sure. I think even though Biden himself, by temperament, I don't think is a radical, I think he is being pulled in certain directions. And I think in this case, even though it is merely symbolic in and of itself, it could be an indication of where he intends to go in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's certainly been pulled further and further to the left. Obviously, throughout the primary debates, there's a lot of pressure to bend to the progressive wing of the party, the wing of the party that controls the narrative on social media and around cancel culture and around everything that dictates what people see from the left, which is not necessarily, of course, what a lot of people inside of the Democratic Party want. I mean, it brings me back to listening to the leaked tape of the Democrats meeting after the 2020 election, where Abigail Spanberger from my home state of Virginia, a moderate Democrat, said she never wanted to hear the word socialism again, because that has alienated a large portion of just run-of-the-mill Democrats. So I think there's a lot of infuding inside of the Democratic Party of what identity they have, what they actually want to see. And even with President Biden's immigration executive order that's going out today, they've basically announced that they're going to, you know, take a second look at the public charge rule that the Trump administration put through last year, 2 years ago now. Whereas advocates on the immigration side of the aisle for Democrats and leftists wanted that rule gone immediately. So they're disappointed now that the Biden administration has decided to sort of slow walk a review of that rule instead of immediately nixing it out of the gate, I think is really just a good example of the uncertainty that's inside of the administration on how progressive they want to be, as well as the party in general, the direction they're trying to go.
Hey, folks, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor, the official razor of the Tom Woods Show, Harry's. I've told you stories, folks, about how when I've been traveling and I've accidentally forgotten my Harry's razor, I've had to pick up some bargain razor at the airport. Oh my gosh, this was not a bargain. Instead of that smooth glide of a Harry's razor and the resulting beautifully close and comfortable shave, it's some kind of hideous torture where it feels like somebody's pulling on my beard whiskers. It's horrible. But with Harry's, you get top quality and a great price, only $2 per refill. They source their steel from Sweden and manufacture their blades in their world-class blade factory. And you are just going to love them. Well, for a limited time, Harry's has an exclusive offer for listeners of my show. New customers can get a Harry's starter set and a free body wash for just $3 at harrys.com/woods. That's over a $16 value for just $3. You get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, a travel cover, and a travel-size body wash. It's an incredibly great deal, but act fast while supplies last. Go to harrys.com/woods to redeem your offer. You mentioned healthcare. I know Biden did something having to do with Obamacare, but honestly, I don't know what it was. So you're going to have to fill me in.
Sure. So the executive order on healthcare was really aimed at, they called it strengthening, quote unquote, Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. You and I know, of course, the Affordable Care Act was neither affordable nor caring. Premiums have skyrocketed on the Obamacare exchanges since Obamacare was passed back in 2010. And has really made healthcare inaccessible for a number of people. There's a hyper focus on how many people are quote unquote covered, how many people have health insurance coverage. But the really critical point here, Tom, is that coverage doesn't matter if people can't access their care through it. And that's the problems we're seeing with Obamacare, with government-run healthcare, is that people, sure, they quote unquote are covered, but they cannot access that care in any meaningful way. And if they're able to, the quality is bad. So the Trump administration had issued a number of rules throughout his 4 years to expand options for healthcare outside of the Obamacare exchanges, outside of people falling onto Medicaid rolls. And that included expanding options for association health plans that allow people and individuals and businesses to band together to offer plans for their employees. Expanding short-term limited duration plans, which are shorter than the standard period of coverage, and allow people, again, just an off-ramp from the Obamacare exchanges for something that's more affordable for them, that maybe is more limited in its coverage levels, but works for people with a lower utilization of care. Also increasing access to health reimbursement arrangements for employers to offer a sum of money to their employees to go out and purchase whatever plan works for them, whether it's on the Obamacare exchanges or in the private marketplace. These types of rules that the Trump administration promulgated, of course, also 1033 waivers for states to create, again, alternatives to the standard Obamacare government-run healthcare plans. The Biden executive order was aimed at strengthening the Affordable Care Act, which means, in essence, taking all of those rules and undoing them. Unfortunately, what that does, of course, is forces people who had alternatives to Obamacare back onto Obamacare rolls or onto Medicaid rolls because they have no other options. Democrats always talk about being the party of choice, but really on pretty much every issue, they want to take away choices from American people unless the choice is the government. I see it kind of as a down payment from the Biden administration on their moves toward a public option, which of course, at the end of the day, we know means eventual elimination of private health insurance. So we've gone from President Obama, who has said during the passage of Obamacare, you know, if you like your plan, you can keep it. You can keep seeing your doctor. Of course, we know that wasn't true. And now we're headed toward a direction where those private plans, not only are they not going to lie and say you can, if you like them, you can keep them, but they're actually going to try to get rid of them. So unfortunately, that's the direction that this executive order has taken us in. And I think it's going to be really detrimental to a lot of people who have found care that works for them.
Now, I think the ones we've talked about so far are the ones that I've seen most in the paper. I mean, I guess the reversal of the so-called Mexico City policy with regard to abortion, but I think that's always been a smokescreen to appease pro-lifers, because since money is fungible, okay, the U.S. government won't fund the abortions, but then the money that funds it, you can, I mean, like, it, right. I don't think it really makes any difference. I don't think any abortion was ever prevented by the Mexico City policy.
Right. So FreedomWorks doesn't engage on social issues, so we didn't take a position one way or the other on the Mexico City policy. I've seen the Republicans in Congress stand up and be disappointed about the direction that the Biden administration has taken it. But I mean, it's just another indication that a lot of these executive orders, like we'd been saying, you know, they flip-flop back and forth from administration to administration based on the whims of the party, the whims of the person who holds the office. But ultimately, at the end of the day, unless these executive orders get made into rulemakings, promulgated, go through the process to become rules that are published in the Federal Register, they can be largely symbolic. So FreedomWorks has a regulatory action center that's tracking all these activities. And then as these executive orders do get promulgated into rulemaking periods with public comment periods, we send out alerts to our activists and let them know, hey, this docket now is open, this docket that would create a rule that would undo the Trump administration's rule on association health plans. They're going to try to roll that back, you know, submit a comment and let the Biden administration know that you actually oppose undoing that rule and you support the option for Americans to choose association health plans if they want to. So that's where we're looking at this with an angle toward, you know, what actual activities and actions and influence can ordinary Americans have on these regulatory rulemaking processes? And fortunately, if they choose to open it up to a public comment period, these bureaucrats sitting there do have to read these individual comments and provide an answer to them to the degree that there are enough of them. And so that'll be our mission.
All right, let's talk about something we spoke about off the air. This is pretty current eventy right now. Mm-hmm. The reconciliation bill and the moves going on connected to that right now for the $1.9 trillion COVID relief. I wouldn't even want to know what's in that thing, honestly. I just wouldn't. But it's your job to do depressing things like this. So what can you tell us about all this?
Absolutely. So we got news at the outset of this week that Democrats in both chambers, in the House and in the Senate, are going to move forward with passing a what is known as a shell budget resolution to set up the stage for a reconciliation bill. And the reason that they do this is because the reconciliation process allows the Senate to bypass the filibuster, meaning that a bill that is considered under reconciliation only requires a majority to pass. Of course, right now we have a 50-50 Senate led by now Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, with the tiebreak as Vice President Kamala Harris. So what the Democrats have decided to do in both chambers, despite all of their talk of unity and wanting to work across the aisle and extending an olive branch to Republicans and Trump supporters to come together as a country. You can just listen to President Biden's inaugural address to see their talking points on that. Of course, now they've turned to one of the most partisan processes, which is budget reconciliation, to attempt to pass a new round of COVID relief. Of course, just about a month ago now, what is it, the end of January, end of December, right around Christmas, Congress passed a previous round of COVID relief that, of course, you and I know they rolled into the Christmas tree omnibus bill that they like to do every year to fund the federal government. And now just a month later, Democrats have said, hey, we want more COVID relief. It's going to be $1.9 trillion, which is the package that President Biden laid out at the beginning of his administration. And we're going to pass it not on a bipartisan basis, but instead through budget reconciliation. And so just at the beginning of this week, they released text for the shell budget that allows them to set up this process. And so it allows for an increase in the federal deficit of $1.9 trillion over the next 10-year budget window, so until 2030. It includes instructions to about a dozen different committees to implement measures that address revenues and outlays, is what budget reconciliation is supposed to be limited to, which is how they're able to do it under this budget process. Some of the things that we expect the future legislation to include: $1,400 in additional per person direct payments to taxpayers, increasing unemployment benefits to $400 per week, money for COVID vaccine, funding, testing, public health programs, funding to reopen schools. Of course, they're going to throw some money to Amtrak, because that's what they like to do, is bail out these federal transportation programs. So no shocker that that's in there. Increased money for SNAP, which are food stamps and other welfare programs. And then included in Biden's package for COVID relief is a $15 minimum wage hike. And that's really where the sticking point is with this reconciliation process, is will Democrats try to flout precedent, ignore what's called the Byrd rule in the Senate, which is actually law, but again, only as enforceable as the Senate decides to make it for itself, and include something that is a policy change that is not just a direct impact on revenues and outlays, and make a what really is a major, major policy change in what's supposed to be limited to a budget bill. So we'll track that resolution as it goes through this week, of course, opposing it on the grounds that A, it sets us up for a $40 trillion debt in just a couple short decades, which is would have been unfathomable, you know, a couple of years ago. Not only would it blow through our spending levels, but also it would set up the process for this bill that you know, just continues to spend us into bankruptcy, does very little to address the pandemic, and then, of course, is just an excuse to pass potentially a $15 minimum wage hike, which we absolutely oppose. So a lot of news this week. We'll be tracking that process going forward and seeing if the Democrats can hold their party together to make it happen.
Well, very interesting. Now, this $15 minimum wage thing, one of the things that they'll say, even though, let's say, about 15, 20 years ago, it was considered just one of the commonplaces of economic knowledge, that if you increase the minimum wage, you know, above the market clearing wage, you're going to have unemployment. I mean, everybody knew that. It was just one of those things that everybody knew. Mm-hmm. But even though everybody knew it, everybody didn't know it. But the economists knew it. But now it's even the economists are getting wobbly on it. And they try to argue, well, we've done some empirical studies, and it turns out, blah, blah, blah. Okay, well, apart from all the flaws in those studies, and there are a lot of them, we've reviewed them on this podcast before, the key thing is going to $15 is close to a 100% increase. Mm-hmm. And none of those studies were looking at what happens if we increase the minimum wage by 100%. And none of them. They were looking at very, very modest increase in the minimum wage. So there is no study that says, so they're just bluffing, or they're hoping you don't look closely at it. The studies they're looking at are very trivial increases in the minimum wage. They have no study to justify this. So again, it's a case where they want to make it seem like they're on the side of so-called science and you're just a stupid hick with a backwards baseball cap. No, sir. As usual, it's the exact opposite. I assure you, it's the exact opposite.
Right. And I mean, I think about Representative Ocasio-Cortez from New York, who I think one of the funniest stories from her first year in office was when she went back to visit the restaurant she used to bartend at that was closing. The reason they were closing was because of a minimum wage hike, the very minimum wage hikes that she and other progressives like to support that they think will, you know, pay a living wage or a fair wage or whatever terminology they want to use to advocate for these types of things. What people don't realize or refuse to acknowledge is that setting these arbitrary numbers, setting arbitrary dollar amounts that people have to be paid will just result in the decimation of a number of businesses across our country. Small businesses that employed nearly half of all Americans can't keep up with this. I saw a report just earlier this week that Amazon supports a federal increase of the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Of course they do, because they're a large corporation able to absorb that cost. And likely, I don't know what their starting pay is, but I imagine it's somewhere around there. The reason that these large corporations will support these types of, you know, blanket federal rules that dictate wages across our whole country is because it stifles their competition. And as advocates of the free market, as advocates of supply and demand, and also to be noted of people's will to just agree, hey, if you want to pay me $6 to work and I want to pay you $6 to work and you're willing to accept that, go for it. Why should the government stand in the way? Just kind of almost as a side note, you know, of course, these large corporations want to get rid of competition, want to get rid of their competitors that threaten their business, and actually will go out and advocate for these types of changes, saying that they're going to be good. Of course, in bad faith, that'll kill a lot of jobs across the country, result in people certainly not being paid $15 an hour. They will be out of work. And unfortunately, will then have to fall on the social safety net that Democrats keep trying to push more people onto. So maybe it's calculated in that way. Maybe I'm a moderate conspiracy theorist, but you know, that's the way that these things shake out.
What's the website for FreedomWorks?
FreedomWorks.org is our website. We're also on Facebook. Facebook.com/FreedomWorks. Twitter as well. Our handle is just @FreedomWorks. All one word.
All right. I'll put all those links up on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1828. And Sarah, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks, Tom. Great to be with you.
All right, folks, that's it for today. Tomorrow, Carla Garrick of the Free State Project comes back to the show, and she's got some juicy details to let us in on regarding what's going on in New Hampshire. So you want to tune in for that. And if you like and appreciate what goes on here on the Tom Woods Show, boy, do I have a lot of goodies for you as a supporting listener of the show, not least of which is membership in the exclusive Tom Woods Show Elite. In your heart, you know you belong in there. Check it out at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.